Welcome to Political OD, episode 43. It's been quite busy since our last podcast with various characters coming and going. I guess the first significant person to leave the stage is Leo Varadkar, which was perhaps not entirely without an expectation after the two referenda that they lost on a constitutional reform in the Republic of Ireland. But on the other hand, nothing seems to embarrass the woke, and perhaps it was a surprise that he actually left government, Owen.
I think that's a good summary, David, because yes, these were two embarrassing and humiliating feats for Varadkar and his way of looking at the world, and I think they were interpreted by most people as really a rejection of those kind of woke ideologies that the Republic of Ireland has become so captured by, even though, you know, the actual substance of the amendments to the constitution that were proposed were, you know, fairly modest in terms of, you know, redefining the family, making that a broader definition to reflect the sort of reality, I suppose, of the modern world, and also a clause on women's duties of care in the home. But it was an opportunity for the electorate in the Republic of Ireland to put down a marker and express their dissatisfaction with many of the things that had happened in their state, including kind of unchecked immigration and other, you know, sort of quite extreme woke ideologies that seem to have been accepted by an elite that doesn't really care what ordinary people think. So I think that certainly the timing of Varadkar's departure was quite sudden. It seemed to come upon people without really anybody getting an inkling that it might be in the offing. But it was part of a kind of broader realignment, a broader sort of reaction against the kind of government that he's led over a number of years. And it's certainly for unionists in Northern Ireland, he will not be lamented, as
no.
You did out, I think, in an article that you wrote recently.
It did strike me at the time as well that he was the second significant leader who doesn't really have a policy agenda. I mean, if you sat down and wondered, what does Leo Varadkar believe in, or what does the government in the South really prioritising, it was difficult to really put your finger on anything significant in broad policy terms. I mean, they talked about housing, they talked about, you know, all these other issues, but they didn't seem to be achieving a great deal. And that may be unfair, but they generally hadn't managed to put through a narrative that they were winning on those issues. And it struck me rather like Sturgeon. Like Varadkar, Sturgeon had come to a point where constantly talking about independence, constantly talking about other issues other than the disasters in health, drugs, crime and justice, education, you know, those things were sort of put to one side. And she finally came down on the gender bill and sending a bloke to a woman's prison. That seemed to be the thing that hit. So it was like the second leader to have fallen on their woke sword, as it were.
It's an interesting analysis, and I kind of see them, I think, as almost mirror images of each other, David, because with Sturgeon, you have basically an ethno-nationalist who cloaked her nationalism in wokery and used the wokery as a way of making her sort of very traditional nationalism more palatable to a modern audience, and also used it to kind of emphasize, as she would have perceived it, differences with the British culture, with the dominant culture on these islands. With Varadkar, it was almost the other way around, because I think he was a sort of woke stroke progressive politician in a sense, or at least that kind of social liberalism was built into him in a way that you couldn't really separate from his political personality. But he used nationalism as a way of reaching out to voters, and he did it in quite a cunning way, because rather than using sort of classical nationalist tropes. He just activated this Anglophobia through the prism of Brexit. While there are similarities there, I think they approached it from slightly different angles, but certainly in the end, the combination of the two things was rather similar.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how Labour, when they get elected, approach all these issues, because the Blair government came in having a very strong economy. This time, Starmer's coming in with an economy that's largely all over the place. It's pretty wrecked. There's not much room to raise taxes. Not a lot of room on the economic front to make a difference. So they're going to have to find policies that they can look as if they're doing something. So it'll be interesting exactly how far they go down some of these social agendas to distract from the fact that they're not doing anything of major policy significance, simply to give a bit of red meat while they're doing something more unpalatable in planning reform or reforming the health service. It'll be interesting to see how all that falls out.
Yes, and this isn't something that's unprecedented, this idea of using sort of socially social issues, quite kind of emotive issues, as a way of directing people's attention and giving a sense of what the government's about,
Well,
whereas they're neglecting bigger issues and economic issues. And we have to get a flavour yet of exactly what Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, is all about. Are they in probably the incoming chancellor, the shadow chancellor at the moment, is all about, and what she believes and just how she sees a Labour-run economy.
classic is Blair used the hunting, the banning of hunting. To provide that red meat to the rabid left, as it were.
And let's remember that David Cameron did something similar with gay marriage when
True.
he came in as Prime Minister, used that to kind of bolster his credentials as a social liberal and somebody who was progressive, because that was a big part of the image that he wanted to portray, even as a Conservative Prime Minister.
And to deflect from the austerity and the economic pain that was necessary at the time, but certainly the gay marriage thing kept people busy on the front pages. Of course, with Bragg gone, in Northern Ireland, we of course have had the departure of the leader of the DUP, Geoffrey Donaldson. Won't talk about that, but I think you can't avoid discussing where the DUP goes now. Because it struck me that they're clinging on to the notion that being the biggest party, they are the leaders of unionism. But without a great deal of confidence in that assertion at the moment. I mean, I detect in Gavin Robinson, it's I am the leader of unionism as a more as a affirmation to try and convince people, but it's not very convincing at the present time.
Well, we can't, of course, talk about Geoffrey Donaldson's arrest specifically, but it is going to have a political fallout. I think there's absolutely no doubt about that. It seems to me that the DUP wants to persuade us at the moment that it's just business as usual, that everything's going to continue as if this hadn't happened. And I just can't believe or rationalize to myself the idea that that will be the case. I mean, there's going to be a very interesting election probably this year, and we've discussed in the past when that will occur. I mean, this provides a great deal of uncertainty as to how that will go. Gavin Robinson himself is sitting on a very small majority in East Belfast. He's styling himself the leader of unionism. Will he even be an MP after the year is out? That's not by any means certain, although it's not to say that he won't be able to defend that seat. And there are other seats too that are a problem for the DUP. So this could be a moment when unionism starts to look at what's happened over the past number of years. You maybe want to go over the last 10 years, 9, 10 years, where a strong position was sort of frittered away and has become really a position where unionism seems to be on the defensive. This could provide, in a sense, and we want to say, I mean, it's not a pretext for this that anybody would have wanted to happen, and it's very disturbing and everything else, but perhaps at some level, it provides an opportunity for unionism to think again and to look at how it has marketed itself and arranged itself over the past few years and sort of wonder about whether there's room for improvement.
The DUP have taken on the mantle of the leadership of unionism since 2007. We look at 2015, which was the election. Cameron won a slight majority, and it's before the Brexit, but the DUP were a dominant force in Northern Ireland politics at that time. They got some of the biggest votes, one of their biggest votes ever. In 2017, they got one of their biggest votes ever. But in the subsequent years, the question I guess you have to ask is, do we feel unionism is in a better place today with the leadership of the DUP in that period or not? And I don't think you can say with much confidence that unionism is in a better place for those years. And if you look at Westminster alone, which is the election that's coming up sometime this year, I have the DUP MPs in Westminster really delivered very much at all? And I'm not sure they have. I mean, not even with a confidence and supply arrangement. In other words, being at the heart of government, having joint meetings between themselves and the Conservative Party in as part of an arrangement to support the government, minuted online. Whether that has actually delivered anything, I can't see any evidence of it having delivered a great deal in that period.
Well, the confidence and supply arrangement delivered the DUP an opportunity to boast about securing money for Northern Ireland. And even some of that, really, if we look at things over the last few years, it hasn't materialized. And we were chatting before we started recording today, David, about the York Street Junction, which was supposed to be part of the confidence and supply arrangement that the DUP negotiated with Theresa May. That hasn't happened. But the greater indictment of the DUP in terms of that is the way that they frittered away the influence and the opportunity that they had to really make a lasting impact on the governance of the United Kingdom and to use their influence in that arrangement to strengthen the union for Northern Ireland, but also in the interests of the whole country. And it is really difficult to sort of mount an argument that they did that effectively. And even in terms of the way that Brexit played out over the years, you have to say that the DUP's role was one of sort of impotent confusion on the sidelines. They just didn't understand the problems as they approached. They didn't see the difficulties with the backstop and the consequences that would come out of that. They agreed to Boris Johnson's proposition that a regulatory border was fine while checks and a customs border was not. Now, that was a complete misreading of the situation. The regulatory border was always a very significant barrier between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, probably the most significant barrier if you're talking about the constitutional impact of the protocol. The DUP didn't seem to understand that. The DUP still doesn't seem to understand that because I listened to Gavin Robinson and this supposedly greatly assured interview that he gave on the BBC to William Crawley the other day. He was still talking about the Irish Sea border in terms just of checks, which are a symptom of the fact that there is that there are trade barriers there. That is not the entirety of substance of the barriers that are there. The regulatory border has not gone, but he didn't seem to show any cognizance of that, or if he did, he was trying to pretend that it wasn't the case. Geoffrey Donaldson, and we don't want to talk about him any more than we have to, he was telling us that there wasn't a constitutional consequence to having a customs border between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. A customs border, even after the protocol was signed by Boris Johnson in February of the following year, he was telling us that there were no constitutional consequences. It's been a litany of misjudgments, errors, misunderstandings. And I don't want to downplay the fact that this was a hugely complicated business. It was hugely difficult to navigate this, but it's almost impossible to make a plausible argument that the DUP did it well.
I think it's impossible to make a plausible argument that they did it well, and therefore to reward them with continued support, I find it increasingly hard to justify. It just seems to be incredible that they would say, we are in a better place. Well, from what point? It's not in a better place than 2007 when they took on that mantle. It's not in a better place when they got the biggest vote ever to stop that pathway that has led to the protocol. They simply haven't delivered on what they promised to deliver. And now we're meant to believe that the border's gone and that we need to go back to Stormont to protect the union. Well, how's that gone in the past 25 years, boys? Because I don't see that Stormont has delivered a strengthened union in 25 years. And I don't see the leadership of the DUP achieving that in the next 25 if they carry on as they are.
The DUP's strongest suit basically is incumbency, and I mean that is always a powerful force in politics. They're there. What's the alternative? There isn't particularly a strong unionist party challenging them at the moment, and they can therefore say, well, if it's not going to be us, who is it going to be? Because if you don't vote for us, probably you're not going to get a unionist at all. You're going to get alliance and national or a nationalist, and that will be worse. But that's about the only rationale that they can offer voters. That's the argument that they've already started making for this general election. And at some point, for the good of unionism, surely we've got to have more than that, because that's a negative, defeatist attitude.
Yeah. If we look at Stormont at the moment, I mean, it's back with a whimper rather than a roar, I think. I'm not quite sure what we've seen since Stormont's return, apart from those photo opportunities. And I was up in Stormont on Tuesday and I looked up at the screen and saw gender budget on the screen. They were discussing gender budget. I don't know what a gender budget is. There must be a budget set as such, but it hasn't come out with any fanfare. What is the budget expectations for the coming year? What is being spent on infrastructure? What is being spent on health? What has been spent on the reform of health? The Ulster Unionists had a debate on Monday on getting a plan together for water infrastructure, but Nicola Mallon published a strategy for water infrastructure. So everybody knows what's required. But as with her opening paragraphs in that strategy, nobody knows where the money's going to come from to make it happen. The aspirations or the wish lists are there, but there doesn't seem to be any reality in terms of how are we going to make this happen? How are we actually going to make the improvements that matter to the public? It's all very well for the Ulster Unionists to talk about water infrastructure. But where's the plan for the reform of health, which has a minister from the Ulster Unionist Party? So surely the Ulster Unionist Party should be leading by example by putting their full weight behind Robin Swan to produce that reform plan that makes Bengoa and all the other reports, which are all pretty much the same over the past 25 years, make that a reality.
Well, you would think that that would be the Ulster Union's priority, given that that's their portfolio. And at the same time, we were told that Robin Swan was the right man for this job because he would hit the ground running and he was ready to go. So that's, perfect example. And at the same time, David, we're sort of 2.5 months now, are we, into this new Stormont dispensation? We still haven't seen the programme for government that's supposed to be the kind of document that spells out what this particular executive is all about. I think, as we pointed out on a couple of occasions before Stormont returned, what were they actually doing for 2 years? Were they not discussing what their priorities would be, what they would have to do when they got back to work? It certainly seems to me that they weren't doing anything of the sort. We haven't to date got a budget. Now, still April. Maybe that's coming up in the sort of final 2 weeks of April. But is it going to be property costed? Is it going to be the kind of document that the audit office is going to look at and say, well, yes, there's a strategy behind this? Or is it just going to be, oh, we'll stick a sum here, a sum there. We'll say that we're putting lots of money into health and cut everything else and not explain how that's going to work. I mean, I know what my money's on. We've talked already about the York Street interchange, the fact that there's absolute chaos in terms of infrastructure and everything else. Water's a part of that. We've got mutualization, which, has been knocked about for years. Maybe there's merits in that, but how's any of it going to be funded? So it's chaos, really, at best. Stormont seems to have resumed its kind of function as this kind of glorified debating society where everybody gets to sound off, but nobody sets about the kind of hard, responsible work of running this place properly. And we're left with, a glorified PR operation with Michelle and Emma running about in their wellies, people going to GAA clubs and, all having a wonderful time together. It's not enough.
It's not, we talk about there being no budget. There's no program for government. I mean, they were sitting around tables for 2 years, and yet as parties, they've not actually worked out what are the priorities coming into this particular period of Stormont. I mean, you do wonder if they're just trying not to do anything that's going to upset anyone between now and whenever the general election's coming up, so that no one's going to point a finger at their department or what they're doing, so that they can simply all glide through business as usual, come out the other side of the Westminster election pretty much the same and largely intact as they are. You have to wonder if they're not just simply making that crude electoral calculation. And I don't think it would necessarily be a better budget if they suddenly sat down and said, no, we need to do this, because I don't think they've got the capacity or competence to actually produce a budget, quite frankly.
There could be an element of that. I'm kind of open to that theory, David. I think it maybe runs deeper than that. And I come back to some comments that Lord Bew made actually in front of the Northern Ireland Committee when they were looking into the effectiveness of the Stormont institutions and the workings of the Belfast Agreement. And I haven't agreed with everything that he said over the last few years, but this struck me as a truism. He said that essentially Stormont was there not to provide good government. Devolution was there not to provide good government. It was just to kind of manage our differences and keep things at a sort of relatively stable, peaceful pitch that we could all get on with things in the rest of our lives in a way that kind of ignored what was going on up there. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But, the jarring thing is that we've spent 2 years being lectured by people who kept telling us what a great difference this place was going to make to our lives, how it was going to tackle all kinds of problems, how it was irresponsible to focus on a protocol that cut us off from the rest of the United Kingdom in preference to getting this vital, democratic institution up and running. And evidence of our own eyes is that that's not the case, and that it is very much this aspect of the so-called peace process, and not a useful working part of government.
We don't know when the general election's coming up. Two periods that are being discussed. One is the October one, which I think is broadly believed to be the case, because it gives time for another financial statement by Jeremy Hunt, another maybe drop in national insurance, which is about as much as they can do, and hopefully interest rates coming down, although noises this morning from the Bank of England suggest that might be slightly later than expected rather than sooner. The other date that has been mooted in this past week or so, perhaps late June, July, that the council elections are going to be so awful that there would be a overwhelming push against Sunak, because he just doesn't cut a break. He's not cutting through. Is it going to be any better in the end of the year than now, that July period? Because there would be a like caretaker leadership that would simply go direct to the polls, maybe also thinking that it would mean that Reform maybe hadn't got their candidate selection sorted out. I mean, last week they removed seven of their selected candidates for past social media stuff. So clearly they're still in a process of getting themselves organized. So maybe sooner would stop them being better organized than later in the year. And maybe also the way the polls are going, it would also stop that inflection point where Reform get within deviation points of the Conservatives polling. Again, since our last podcast, the TUV have announced an agreement with Reform. TUV and Reform seem to be determined to have candidates in every seat in Northern Ireland. The earlier the election, general election, the less likely TUV Reform would probably be ready to make that difference in terms of organisation. TUV Reform Alliance is interesting because they've made an agreement on the union, broad economic policies, and matters on migration. They've really kept it to a very narrow policy agenda, leaving it open to really appeal to the two threads of unionism, one, a more traditional unionism, and then maybe the other to a unionism that is more nationally orientated, that would be more policy orientated, that might actually end up fixing things in Northern Ireland.
Yes, I mean, the idea of broadening out unionism and appealing more to that kind of UK unionist sensibility is always a healthy one and a positive thing. Whether, Reform are broad enough to fulfill that criteria, I don't know. But at the same time, they will appeal to a certain electorate. They will also maybe appeal to a broadening electorate because people are beginning to look beyond the Conservative Party now and, particularly sort of traditionally centre-right people, but on the sort of right of that kind of social spectrum, they are beginning to kind of reassess and seeing and starting to see Reform as an option that they will explore. So in a sense, I mean, it should broaden the TUV's appeal because to date it has been, it's been seen either as a kind of protest alternative to the DUP. If you don't like the DUP, it's an option and you're not sort of ready to go along with the more kind of alliancey progressive image that Doug Beattie projects. You might consider the TUV. Perhaps this will start to kind of broaden out that base a little. As you say, if the DUP start experiencing difficulties in seats, well, that's on the DUP, to be quite frank. That's down to the failures of its leadership over a number of years. It's down to, repeated controversies that it's been involved in. They can't turn around and say, well, we would have won this seat or that seat had it not been for the TUV. That's just, not credible. It's going to be their own issues that give them difficulties at this election, as much as the statistics do tell a story and everything else. In terms of when the election happens, I mean, as far as I can tell, there's three sort of good reasons why it might be a late one. Firstly, to give the economy a chance to sort of turn around to an extent, and you're talking about interest rates. The sort of expectation was that interest rates might drop in the autumn, but you're saying that that might not now happen or might not happen to the same extent. And in any case, we're not expecting anything close to the kind of low interest rates that we saw at one time. Maybe those weren't even a good thing anyway. So that's going to be a limited factor. The other two reasons, basically keeping a Labour government out for as long as possible and stopping it doing any damage that might entail. And the other is getting the planes to Rwanda going, which Sunak still believes that he can get those planes going out in the summer or in the autumn at least. And that remains to be seen. And it remains to be seen how sort of critical a difference that will make to voters, because I think there's, a fairly much an acknowledgement that the planes to Rwanda aren't going to solve the problems with massive migration that over the last few years and all the issues that that's raised. So all of those arguments for having a late election, leaving it as late as possible, leaving it until January, they're valid enough, but they're not exactly conclusive. So yeah, I mean, it could be. I'm going to end up keeping all my options open, David, and saying it could be June or July, could be September, October, or potentially November or even January. So I've only ruled out a couple of months there, I think. I don't think we're going to have an August election, but other than that, it could be
No.
any time.
I think the regardless, I think the general election will be very difficult for the TUV Reform Alliance in standing in seats simply because it's first past the post. Also true, of course, in the rest of the UK, where even if Reform had a candidate in every seat, it's going to be very hard to get over the line to get anybody elected. So whilst we may see the demise of the Tories, I think you're looking at Reform as a longer term project, and that probably it's going to be 5 years, the next general election, if well, 2 or 3 years perhaps, of the next general election, to basically see the real consequences of Reform entering the political fray. And I think that may also be true in Northern Ireland, whether Reform can do anything much in the Westminster election, certainly not in terms of winning seats. But the issue then is getting yourself recognized and preparing for the council assembly elections in the next 2, 3 years.
Reform needs to be able, after this election, to be able to turn around to people and say that it's making progress, that it's
Progress.
building
Yeah.
itself up into a force that is credible and that can, and at some point, challenge for, significant numbers of seats. If it gets itself into the House of Commons at all, I think there'll be a degree of satisfaction with that. If it's got, two or three seats, upwards, then it will start to look at that role of kind of the third party. But we've seen in the past that that's a really, really difficult place to be. It's a really difficult thing to establish. And even once you're there, the first past the post system makes it difficult to grow. It's something interesting to watch.
Yeah.
It's not by any means going to be the situation that you've seen in other countries where a kind of populist party has just come surging up in the polls and really become a significant third force in politics. And in Northern Ireland, it will be exactly the same. If the TUV can sort of turn around after this election and say, well, look, we've done pretty well in this election, we've got significant votes, I think they'll be, quietly satisfied with that. And then they'll see it as something that they can build on and look to capitalize on in years to come.
Yeah, I think people keep mentioning the Canadian example where the Conservative Party went down to 2 seats, and then Reform came back, and of course Harper was Prime Minister from that Reform background. However, the National Party in Canada had already a very strong electoral presence in the Western states, and it kind of moved from west to east in a way that Reform hasn't got that defined electoral base at the present time from which to build. And even in council elections, it's not putting forward a massive number of council candidates either. So it's not really going to make an impact at local government at this time, which would have been a pickup. They're in nowhere like the position UKIP were or the Brexit Party were in 2019. It's one of those things that probably excites, but there's a long way to go to see actual impact on the ground.
Yeah, it's always interesting to have realignment, to have new parties, and to see how that plays out and to kind of speculate on what their platform might be and the kind of people that they might appeal to. I feel that with Reform, that's still yet to take shape to an
Yeah.
extent. I mean, are they appealing to the kind of red wall voters that the Tories had the last time? Is that what it's about? Is it about kind of anti-woke populism and immigration and those kind of topics? Or is it more red-blooded kind of free market conservatism? Because you have that element to it too, including the leader, the people who it kind of attracts in and around the sort of London area, where you have that kind of free market, liberalism. Is that what it's about? Can you combine those two things in the way that Boris Johnson and people like that have done in the past? It all very much remains to be seen, and it's a vehicle that has the potential to have a very definite shape put upon it, but that certainly hasn't happened yet. And I think we're all waiting to see what will occur over the next few years in that regard. It's all still to be played for.
I think on that note, we'll end here, and perhaps come back after the council elections in May and take a view on what's going to happen next, whatever befalls the Conservative Party in that particular election. So until next time, Owen.
Thanks.